Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zeslowski. I'd like you to guess whether I just hit play on the song called Oh Yeah by the musical group Yellow, or I'm doing this myself.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Bump, bump.
This is episode number 35. Well, howdy, my friend. Did you like that weird intro? I felt like it was the appropriate time to bust it out since my phlegm factory is in full effect. Feeling a little under the weather, but otherwise okay. Kind of gross, right? Well, that is the phlegm part, not the intro part. That's got me thinking, though. I might do a rendition of a segment of the Humpty Dance by the Digital Underground as an intro for a future show if the conditions manifest like the current conditions are ripe for my version of
Oh Yeah.
Kind of like when I got popped in the nose on the basketball court when I was 14 years old and was so plugged up for a few days that I couldn't help but talk like Greg Shock G. Jacobs, the lead singer of the group The Digital Underground. Anywho's, today's episode is another one in the Smart and Simple Matters curating series. This follows on the heels of episode 5, where I gave an overview of what has evolved into my concept of experience curating. Episode 14 with video curator and best-selling author Steve Rosenbaum. And episode 23 with the curator's curator, Robin Good. Now, even if you're not into this whole curating dealio yet, you will get a few things out of this episode with Guillaume, the CEO and co-founder of an all-star curating platform named Scoop It. We talk about business failures and how they lead to future success, how curation can make you into an expert on any topic you love, why curating is an evolution of human expression, and a simple one at that, and what this concept of human rhythm is, and of course, why that matters. As I progress through the steps in getting my experience curating book published, which, by the way, is still on track to come out in early 2014, I've been thinking about other ways that I can add value to people's lives through curating. Now, I'm going to bounce an idea off you at the end of this episode that I've never mentioned to anyone before. So stick around for that whole shebang and let me know what you think of a potential new reoccurring feature on Value of Simple. You can even use the show notes at valueofsimple.com/SASM035 or the new SpeakPipe voicemail I just installed on Value of Simple to leave me feedback if you like. More about all that stuff later. But right now, let's get into the groove with Guillaume. Here we go. Welcome to another seriously groovy episode of Smart and Simple Matters, everyone. You are about to join me in geeking out on a topic that has come to partially define who I am and what I do, and that would be curating. But I'm not about to have some abstract, philosophical conversation with my guest today that gets you thinking, but not actually doing. My guest, Guillaume de Cugis, is the co-founder and CEO of a prominent curation platform called Scoop It, which, by the way, just launched version 4.0, a major revamp of their system that has received wide acclaim. Before he got cranking on his method of blogging without blogging and publishing via curation, he led a company called MusicWave, which was eventually sold for $120 million. Back in 2006, and has had a number of other successful ventures. But Guillaume is more than just a music or curation guy. He is a lover of massive multiplayer online games, which I can definitely appreciate, loves carving up the ski slopes, surfing in the ocean, and currently hangs out in San Francisco most of the time. We'll get more into his story in a moment, but first, I just want to say, welcome, Guillaume. I am jazzed to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Joel. It's thanks for the great intro, and I'm super happy to have this discussion with you. So thanks for having me.
You got it. Well, let's start off where I normally start off, and we will talk about your seeds of awesomeness, some of the foundational things that make you you, that help us understand you better. And a lot of those end up happening in your youth, even before you start in business or go on to higher education. Can you tell us maybe one or two things about your environment or a specific experience that you had growing up that helps us understand you better?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that, a story I like to tell because I think it helps people, especially people who think about becoming entrepreneurs, is so when I was a student, when I was younger, I had absolutely no idea about becoming an entrepreneur. And the reason for that is that I actually felt this was impossible for me to become one. It was too risky. There was, to me, the picture I had of entrepreneurship was, you win big or lose big. And I felt this is really risky. I can't do this. Like if I fail, you become homeless, and I have like that type of cliche. But this was totally not my career plan. And I've been an entrepreneur now for 13 years. You know, it all changed by changing perspective. What happened is I was fascinated by the U.S. and by, you know, the technology in general. My dad was in a computer company in Europe. He got me an Apple II, one of the first ones. When I was a kid, I started to code in BASIC and stuff like that. So I guess I'm a geek, and I love the U.S. And so I wanted to do a part of my studies in the U.S., and I was lucky enough to get into Stanford University. And that totally changed my perspective because suddenly I became surrounded by people who wanted to be entrepreneurs, who were seeing Stanford as a way to understand entrepreneurship, study entrepreneurship, build the right connections. And it was 94, 95. It was a great, there was the start of the internet. It was when, the people who founded Yahoo and Google were still at Stanford or just out of it. And so I was immersed in that. And I realized that those were real human beings. And in my mind, they were not. In my mind, Steve Jobs and even the average entrepreneurs were like superheroes. And they are. But they, it was good to hear them talk about their experience. And something that was really impressive for me is they all failed at some point. And I realized that success and failure are really associated in their stories, and that it's okay to fail. You're not going to be, losing everything if you fail once. And so that changed completely my perspective. I realized actually this could be something I could do sometime in my life. And I didn't, start a company right immediately out of Stanford. I did some other stuff in between, but when I had an opportunity, I felt, yeah, I can do this now. And so that was really a structuring experiment.
Yeah, I have to imagine that going to Stanford, being in Silicon Valley, sometimes it might seem like it's hard not to become an entrepreneur, being around that spirit and being around that heart of entrepreneurship that we have. But you mentioned, and I resonate with this too, until you're really okay with failure, or you're willing to deal with the implications of failure, sometimes you can't succeed. So I would imagine as you're going through Stanford, as you graduated for them, you probably had some initial failures, some struggles, some challenges before you got ramped up to start doing the things that you're doing right now. Was there one in particular that really held you back but has made you a better person as a result of it?
Well, this is interesting because maybe it's my character, but I really felt that, I had the typical teenager's failures, like, not getting, not having much success with girls as a
geek. Tell me about it.
all right. But maybe because I was a good student, I remember like asking myself, like, when you're like 24 and you're looking for a job and they tell you, hey, you're gonna have that question as a job interview of like, what's your biggest failure? And I was like, gosh, I don't have a failure. I don't have a massive failure. So when I was 25, I didn't have a massive failure that I could tell. And I didn't have that. I mean, I was lucky enough not to have one. And, you know, my first failure is really more what we did right before Scoop It. As a young guy, I was like really lacking that. I was, and again, I don't wish I had failed many times before, because, you know, if you don't fail, then that's great. Good for you. But, I was lacking that. I didn't have much, I was lucky enough to, you know, be a good student and, had good, great academic results. And I think I knew failure in my professional life after. And I had problems to deal with that originally, because I didn't want to recognize it as failure. And I didn't like, you know, challenges that I could not overcome.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I, up until I was about 30, so about 4 years ago, things were very comfortable and stable for me. And I hadn't really attempted anything outside of my comfort zone, and therefore I hadn't really put myself in a position to fail. And I remember those interview questions coming straight out of higher education in college when I was 21, getting my first corporate job. They asked me that question that you were talking about, what's your biggest failure? I had to totally make it up, because I didn't have one. And like you, I've failed a number of times now, and I'm comfortable with it. It's just a natural part of life and entrepreneurship. But you're right. You don't wish for it. It's not like I sat when I was 25 years old thinking, man, I really wish that I would have failed more right now and that I'd have all these great things to talk about. So I get what you're saying there. But it does build character, and it does get you to the point where you can do some pretty amazing things like you're doing right now. So first up, I believe that the people listening would really benefit from knowing the origin story of Scoop It. Can you share that with us, please?
Yeah, and so it you know, it's back to the failure question. We actually created Scoop It after failing at a first product. And so even though technically it's the same company, I like to think about, you know, really we failed the first time, and then we pivoted, as we say in Silicon Valley. We it's almost like we created a new company. And so the context for that was that so Mark, who's my co-founder, and I, we were just out of a successful startup. He had just sold his company to IBM. My first company, MusiWave, had been acquired by Microsoft. I was in the mobile industry, and I had worked in the mobile industry for, you know, since I graduated from Stanford. So I was more like a mobile industry guy. And our first project was really, hey, we felt mobile internet was going to change. And that was 2007, so 6 years ago. And that was before the iPhone, before we had Androids and smartphones as we know them now. Mm-hmm. And so we really started working on that, like, what's the future of mobile internet? And we had this great vision, which is kind of funny as I'm going to describe it. It was like, hey, why don't we build an interface where we can have little icons, each of them, that you could choose and customize the way you want, and each icon would be linking to your favorite service, be it Facebook, you know, Twitter, or YouTube, whatever. And our vision was really the App Store before the App Store. So, you know, it was really funny, because we started working, and as a small startup, we started working on that, and suddenly Steve Jobs introduced the App Store, and we're like, wow, we're screwed. So we're never going to be able to compete with Apple. And then, to make things even worse, then Google comes and say, yeah, well, we have our App Store as well. It's called Android and the marketplace. So we had like this huge strategic problem. And so we started to iterate the product. But and this is where, like, not having failed before probably didn't help, because instead of recognizing that that's okay, situation is completely f***ed up, we have to change everything, we try to iterate. We try to kind of like you know, I'm a stubborn guy, and we try to get out of this problem through evolutionary steps. So we try to iterate the product. We try to come out with small changes that could make it a viable product. We became an iPhone app. We became an Android app. We focused on some of the widgets that we had built. I don't want to go too much into detail of the product, but the big picture is we were making marginal changes. The context we were in is, it was an investment thesis in our company, which was mobile internet is going to change. It's going to be looking a lot more like the web. and we can be the company that does that.
Well, you talk about context a lot. That's a big word that you use, that I use, and you also talk about the App Store a lot. Talk about something that needs some serious curation. Oh, my goodness. I have trouble navigating those these days. Anyway, I digress. But as far as Scoop.it goes, what is it? How do you explain the purpose of Scoop.it to the uninitiated?
Yeah, so we started working on that 3 years ago, and then so we had failed that project, and we were looking at what can we be doing now that's different, but that is something we feel is a good problem, and we felt that a lot of people, including us, were frustrated by the promise of social media. So we had been coming from Web 1.0 to Web 2.0, and the promise was that with Web 2.0 we could all be content creators, we could all be content publishers, we could all become media. And the reality is that it worked for some people, but not for a lot of people, because creating content takes time. It takes focus, dedication, talent, and it's not everyone that could do that. So there was this promise, and specifically for people who had a professional need or a business need to become media, who would who had some expertise or who had a great story for their company and wanted to tell the story, the only way they had available was the blog, the podcast to some extent, making videos. But all of those things takes a lot of time. I mean, that you have a successful podcast, it's a job.
It is.
And a lot of people are saying, hey, I'm a lawyer. My job is to be a lawyer. It's not to become a blogger. Or my job is to run a company of 20 people. It's not to be a blogger. And so that was the starting point. We felt this promise is not delivered. And it's increasingly important to deliver it because there was actually increasing value in because of information overload. Because some of us have become content creators and it became more and more civil to create content. The need to actually have people who can become gateways, who can become resources, who can become those content curators that can save us from information overload has never been higher. So we felt, on one hand, we have a lot of people frustrated because they cannot express themselves through blogging or videos or podcasts because they don't have the time or the talent to do that. On the other hand, we've never needed so much qualified, relevant content, curation. And so we felt, well, let's build the two together. Our basic assumption that was that people who had expertise could become curators in a much easier way that they could become content creators. Not saying it's easy, but it's easier in the sense that we all read a lot of content, we all consume a lot of content, and for a lot of us who've been working for a few years in a specific field, we know when a piece of content is good. And so we felt if we make it easy and rewarding for them to discover that content, enrich it with their own expertise, publish it and share it to the world, then we can turn people who want to become media into effective media publishers. And they can have an impact. They can build their reputation online through this, their personal brand or their business brand. They can raise awareness for a cause. They can educate other people. That's really the need we're filling, helping people become media publishers.
And the emphasis is on significance and relevance in terms of what you are publishing, what you are curating. Because you mentioned there are some people who simply don't have time to create. There are other people who simply don't have time to consume. That is just this massive fire hose, and they can't deal with it. You mentioned overwhelm, and it kind of reminds me, there's a great quote of a woman who I believe is on your platform, Karen Dietz. She said that when we are flooded with information, having a voice in the wilderness to cut through it all helps people make sense of it. We identify the most valuable trees, that we being curators, and cut a path in the forest for people to walk through. I've seen tons of folks on your platform doing that for others, being that guide, being that signpost and those markers, helping people along their path on whatever topic or subtopics that they're passionate about. So I get that you're talking about, or what you're talking about when you come to this blend of publishing and curation. Do you have a couple of ideas so that we can really conceptualize it? Are there a couple of people in particular that you can tell us about and how they're using the platform that you have?
Yeah, and thanks for quoting Karen, because we love to talk about our community. And she does a great topic on storytelling with lots of great curation. To give you another example, you know, I love to talk about Lauren Moss. I'm sure you haven't heard of her, but and this is really a good example because we're not a platform for celebrities to have yet another channel. We're helping people who are not web celebrities become effective media publishers. So Lauren Moss, she's an architect in Orange County. Again, her day job is to be an architect. And if you know architects, they're pretty busy, like super busy. Like she does that 150% of her time. She has this great page on sustainable architecture on Scoop.it, where she curates lots of trends and ideas and what's going on in architecture that can be green and eco-friendly. And that's really how she differentiates as an architect, is she is for responsible design and sustainable architecture. And so she curates a page on this. Because that's her expertise, this page is awesome. And if you're like interested in architecture or like how the future of architecture can be consistent with saving the planet and all of this, her page is wonderful. And you know, we'd like to think about this as something which is not just easier but rewarding for our users. And she grew her audience on Scoop.it to more than 100,000 people. So even though that's by far not a full-time job for her, and she only has little time to dedicate to this, she had a tremendous impact. And that, I'm sure, you know, that generates business leads, awareness, that helps her reputation, all of the things that independent professionals need to develop to be successful in this very open economy that we have with the internet where we're all online and we have a reputation to build.
So yeah, I'll link to her Scoop.it page in the show notes along with a couple of other folks. I'll link to Robin Good, who has previously been on this show. He has an amazing Scoop.it page that I love tearing through and that I follow extensively. And I guess that's why I've read that Scoop.it has attracted more than 80 million visits since it launched about 2 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, and so you know that's really something that, If you like I said earlier, we wanted something that's rewarding, and so we felt blogging is now simple enough. You can do it. The problem is nobody's going to read your blog if you don't spend a lot of time building the audience on it. And we're not saying stop blogging. We're saying create the content you can, but you should also curate, because we kind of like use a model which is a topic-centric model, where what you create on Scoop.it is a topic page. It's a content site on a given topic, and it helps you be discovered. So we've thought a lot about how do we help those people be discovered, because they're going to be curating the world's best content on a given topic. We owe it to them to make it easy for others to be found. And that's, you know, we're very proud of this number of, you know, our community has done an amazing job. They've curated more than 50 million pieces of content. And they've had more than 80 million visits in less than 2 years of different people. So that's amazing. And you were talking about Robinhood. That's another great example. He passed more than a million visits on his topic pages. He's not a huge company. He's doing that alone. He's very talented. He's a great curator.
Yeah.
But a million is like, and we had a few others pass a million visits on their Scoop.it pages. So
it's on all hosts of topics, right? I mean, for me, I love minimalism and simplicity and paleo and personal finance and a whole bunch of other things. I can do all that on Scoop.it. It's topic independent. And people can follow me as an individual, or they can follow my topics. So if I curate 9 different things and someone only cares about 2 of those 9 things, they don't care anything about how I curate and my concept of experience curating. They only care about my personal finance things. They can just pick those out very easily and follow along with that and ignore all the rest. That's one of the things that I've seen about Scoop.it that's a little bit different than the rest of the folks, where because you have this topic-centric view, people can filter down to that granular level and only get what they want and not all the rest, which in a world with so much noise is really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things we've been That's one of the things we've been different from others about. Like in all of the social services or platforms out there, you're used to making friends, making contacts, following people. All of those are people-centric models. If you think about it, most of the services you use right now is you can follow Joel, you can be friends with Joel, you can be a contact of Joel, and those are based on people relationship, and that is awesome because we like to connect as human beings. But that is not the best way to build relevance, because as you said, or if I take my own example, you've said I'm in gaming and skiing and entrepreneurship. Those are all topic pages I curate on Scoop.it, but I don't force people to like all of those and have an interest for all of those. And it would actually be very hard to build a discovery mechanism where I would get a lot of visibility for all of that, because not everyone is interested in that. So the reason we're successful and the reason we've built that massive audience is because we help people be, as we say, shining on the web on their particular topics of interest.
Well, you've already mentioned a number of different steps within your curation process. You've talked about discovering, you've talked about organizing, you've talked about sharing. There's a lot of different components in the way that you practice it. Maybe I should take a few steps back on this whole curating business, because regular listeners of the show and readers of Value Simple, they know that, at least from my perspective, this experience curating concept that I have, there's six critical steps in curating, whatever it is, like anything that you can possibly have. I call it FOCAS. It's an acronym, FAOCAS. It stands for filter, archive, organize, context, access, and share. Now, I'm not going to go into the details
of
each of those curating steps right now, but I'm interested, at least from your perspective and Scoop.it's perspective, how many core steps do you think that there are in the curating process?
So we like to... I love your acronym. We like to say it's about content discovery. It's about making that content yours, in the sense we want this to be something you enrich with your own perspective, and that you organize with your own particular view of the topic on your content site. And then sharing. You know, curation is about, for us, is an expression means. And our starting point, again, was like, all of those people didn't know how to express themselves efficiently with blogging or Twitter and social networks. They wanted more. And so we think curation is a means to an end, which is expression. So and now our sub-steps, but we like to think about those three things which are essential, like discover content that you will want to share, making it yours by enriching it, adding value to it, organizing it on your content site, and then sharing it to the world. And this can be social sharing, but we've also integrated with email platforms to send newsletters. We integrate with blogging platforms. Again, we're not saying curation is against creation, but is a way to complete it. But those are like the three big steps that we see.
Gotcha. And that expression that people have, they might choose to express themselves with a number of different goals. So some people might do it to plant a flag in the ground and tell people this is what's important to me. Other people might do it to try to educate or inspire or become a go-to, an expert in whatever topic that they're passionate about. It sounds like at least folks on your platform are curating for any number of reasons, and you don't necessarily need to have a specific goal in mind when you start doing it. You might realize some benefits from it, whether that's personally, professionally, socially, spiritually even, that you don't anticipate when you start it.
The common point, you're right, and we've been amazed by the diversity of users we have from, you know, we took the example of Lauren. She's an independent professional or an SMB owner. We have startups. We have a lot of people and a lot of business people. But we've also had educators. We've also had nonprofits. So it's been really amazing. Now, the common point between all of those people is that they want to have an impact with content, with the content they curate. And the word impact is something we don't take lightly. They want to build a community. They want to build an audience. They want to they are not just, you know, collecting content for themselves. And there's been, I think, you know, that's what killed social bookmarking platforms, which are like maybe the what pre-existed before curation platforms.
Like Delicious, for example, right?
Yeah, I think Delicious wasn't really clear. I mean, they've done a great job, but it was never clear to me whether this was something I did for me or for others. Like social bookmarking is like taking those two very different things and making it a hybrid. Bookmarking is for me. Social, what does it mean? And I think we wanted to be very clear that this is something you do to have an impact, to build an audience or a community, to engage people. Like even teachers when they use Scoop-It, like there's been great stories on Scoop-It being used in K-12, for instance, like teaching kids critical thinking, like how do I know when I read something on the internet whether it's legitimate, is it fact checked, or how do I know it's real? And I think there's a lot of at stake here, because if our kids don't understand that there are stuff on the internet that's totally wrong, that's then how can they make their own judgment? So you got to learn to curate, and that's creating an impact. I mean, education is one of the most impactful thing we can do. The common point between all of these people is that they want to make an impact with content.
So can we talk just briefly, this Smart and Simple Matters show, it's most often about the themes of simplify, organize, and be money wise. Mm-hmm. Are there specific ways that Scoop-It will let me have a more simplified, organized, or money wise life?
Yeah. So the kind of ROI equation of Scoop-It is really around saving you time doing a number of things you need to do to exist online. You might like it or not like it. It's a fact that now, if you want to be found online, and if you're either for, again, personal reasons or to make an impact as a nonprofit or as a business, you need to be discovered. And the time where all you needed is just a static site with a page on who you are, a page on your products and services or whatever, or as an individual, the time where you could just be a profile on LinkedIn and not touch it, this is gone. Like right now, all of the, what Google search, well, social network, the way traffic is being built, the way audiences are being built, it's only through dynamic content. So there's a trend on the web, which is you have to become a media. And so where Scoop-It will make your life simple is it will save you time, discover great content to publish. So it automates, we have this, the starting point for Scoop-It is this big data semantic technology that crawls more than 10 million pages every day for our users and then qualifies those pages on the fly, connected with the keywords they're looking to publish on, and serves them that content as content suggestions. So we automate the discovery, but we let you do the publishing, because we think it's very important to draw a clear line between automated aggregation, which we feel has little value, and meaningful curation, which is the second step that I was describing, the make it yours. This is where you're going to be acting as a DJ. Anybody's experiencing the difference between a good DJ and a bad DJ. It's not just playing music. It's not just playing good music in a random order. This is where you're going to be saying, hey, this piece of content goes with this piece of content. And we make that super easy because, one, we've organized things in topic pages. So you create a topic page. It's clearly defined. The format is very visual. So all of that is very simple for you to do. And you can enrich all of the content you curate and publish. So you link back to the original sites, but you can add your insight. And we it's often very easy to say, okay, here's what I have to say on this particular article. And we also save you time by allowing you in the same process to cross-post it to all of the social channels that you want to be on. So Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter.
Yeah, you can become a super DJ. I love that analogy of the DJ too, because there's a huge difference. We've all been to weddings before where somebody just puts an MP3 player on random. and there's no context. They don't understand what kind of audience is there, or whether it's time for a slow dance, or whether it's time to just get down and boogie. And a real DJ can read the crowd. They can take thousands of potential sources of experiences in individual songs. They can narrow them down to just a handful that might be appropriate in any given time, and then pick just the one that's appropriate to share with everyone who wants to know or wants to have that experience. I really like that analogy of the DJ too. But you know, one of the things that I have, because thinking of yourself as a DJ and a curator is a great way to do it, but I often see people just putting things on random, just blasting things out there, even though they're doing the essential human element of curation. Because you're right, if you're just aggregating and you're automatically publishing, that's not curating. There's human filtering that needs to be involved. There's layers of context that need to be added in order for you to enrich that original experience that you're sharing. Are there certain best practices of curating, though, that you see people getting wrong over and over again?
Some people try to take shortcuts, and some people try to think about automation as one of those. And again, there are things you can automate. We even have a word for that. We like to think of what we're doing as human rhythm. So, and that word is like, we want to mix humans with algorithms, and use algorithm where they're good at and humans where they're good at. So one thing humans are not good at is crawling 10 million pages every day. It's impossible to do. And even if you just want to crawl content on search content on your particular topics, you can spend hours doing that. Oh, so yeah. We use robots, so our own algorithm to do that. And that's where we bring technology. But we, as I said, we draw a clear line saying nothing on Scoop.it is published automatically. So we don't automate publishing, because we feel this is your decision. This is, you have suggestions, and sometimes our algorithm, our robot, is going to be right, and sometimes you're going to say, nah, I don't like this. And even when you like it, you want to spin it the way you want. So we like to give the possibility for you to change the title, to change the picture, to make it your own, and to add this insight I was mentioning. And there's a clear correlation on our platform in terms of like how much search traffic, how much traffic in general, how much engagement you're getting. It's clearly all of that is clearly correlated to how much insight you're putting in your curation. And again, you know, we shouldn't think of this as something which is complicated, because it would be extremely hard for me to provide great insights on art, on, you know, topics I have no expertise on. But again, coming back to my example of Lauren Moss, she's an architect. Every time she reads something on architecture, she has something to say about it. It comes very naturally, because we're all experts at something. And that's one of our core values. We wouldn't be doing that if we didn't feel that every professional, every human being at some point becomes an expert at something because they're really good at doing what they're doing. It's one of our values, and we feel it's just a matter of making that easy to express, that expertise, and building that on top of existing content comes much more naturally. And so that's a good practice we try to promote.
Yeah. So this concept of content curation, if you're already going to be spending all this time consuming, you might as well spend a little bit of time curating.
Exactly.
And then adding value to another people's lives. This is what I tell people all the time. I'm like, if I'm spending 99.9% of all of my time and my resources putting myself in a position to have amazing experiences, to read amazing books, to listen to great podcasts, all these different things, I might as well spend 0.1% of my time consolidating all of those gains and curating all of those experiences for my benefit, but also to benefit other people now and in the future for an indefinite period of time. And that's one of the main selling points that I have for curating. And people have been doing this for millennia, but going back to the ancient Romans in terms of creating this role of a curator for their empire. And obviously, things have shifted significantly in the 21st century in terms of what curation looks like. Content curation is a huge part of it too, but it even goes beyond that to anything that you might encounter and experience.
So that's amazing, because that's, you know, we there's a couple of things. First, I also love to say that when you've read or consumed content, you've done the hard work, and you can judge whether it's worth sharing. And we like to think about you've done 90% of the work. And so now we make it very easy for you to do the other 10% because we've created a workflow that make it super simple. And the other thing you said is we think of content curation as something that you've mentioned history, and we're big history fans. Mark and I, Michael Fender and I, my wife's a history teacher, so I guess I have to be.
Uh-huh.
We like to think about curation as an evolution of human expression. If you think about the history of human expression, of written expression, we've had the invention of writing a few thousand years ago, and ever since we invented writing, the technology has done only one thing: make it more possible for a lot of people to read or consume content from a growing but still very small number of people. Like up until the end of the 20th century, you know, we had 90% of people who could read, reading stuff that was produced by the 1%. And it's only very recently that we've been actually changing that, with like now everybody can create content. And so we think that there's been this massive evolution of technology, which is what we call mass media in the 20th century. And now we're changing the model because we've moved from a model which is a one-to-many model to a many-to-many model. And this is precisely why we have this many-to-many model, that we need this curation layer in between. And we think of it as, you know, the next step in human expression, which is we had the ability to write, but only a few of us were published authors or got on TV. And then we now all have the ability to create. But this is not something that really cracked it for the masses, and human curation could be the next evolution in terms of human expression. So we like to see that in a historical perspective as well.
Yeah, what a blessing and a curse that everybody can create now in so many different ways. But holy cow, does it make it difficult to live, especially digitally. I'm glad that you've shown us that curation in general, historically or currently, whatever, and content curation in particular, yeah, it's not just a passing fad. It's this super important thing that's going to continue to be even more important for all the reasons that you have mentioned, that previous guests on the show like Steve Rosenbaum and Robin Good have mentioned. I couldn't agree more with you there, Guillaume. But I do want to ask you one last question, though, to take wherever you feel like you want to. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you would like people to know?
I mean, I can talk forever.
Well, maybe we'll have a follow-up episode. But for this time around, what do you think?
We've had this big success of making each individual user of Scoop.it a media publisher and having an impact with it. And, you know, a question that often comes when we talk about content curation is say, well, but if we help people become media publisher through curation, are we creating more noise? Like, how do we curate the curators? And it's a bit meta, but as we help people become media publisher through curation, because it's topic-based curation, because it's topic-centric, we can have a model where we can have a long tail of topics that are not colliding with one another. Just because somebody curates on architecture, if you're not in architecture, you don't get polluted, because again, you don't have to follow her topic on architecture. If you like her page on social media, you can follow it. And so we've talked about that. But the second thing we've added is we've just created with the V4 of Scoop.it what we call interest channels. And we're, you know, to my knowledge, we're the first platform, the first curation platform to do that. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it works. But so far, the success has been, you know, the feedback has been overwhelming and positive. Our community loves it. So the way we're also applying human rhythm to curate the curators. Instead of building just algorithms that would dictate who's a good curator on Scoop.it and how to group them in you know, categories, we created categories, what we call interest channels, but we let people opt in their curation in the category, the interest they want, and then we let the top curators in that category, a bit like peer reviews in science, recommend the topics, so the curation they feel are worth recommending. So we use our community to actually curate the curators. And as we have a growing, a fast-growing community of people who are really talented and experts, this is going to be fascinating to see how it evolves. So from now on, it's good, like since our launch about 10 days ago, you can go discover the interest channels, but those are really good. And they've been like handpicked by a mix of algorithms, their own curators, and the rest of the community who vetted them and recommended them. So it's a new model we're bringing, and it's going to be very interesting to look at.
That is meta, and that is pretty cool. Well, if people want to know more about ScoopIt or they want to know more about you, where should we look online?
Well, ScoopIt is simply scoop.it. We have a blog where we like to talk about knowledge sharing and content curation, of course, which is blog.scoop.it. And they can find me also on ScoopIt, ScoopIt/GDECUGIS.
Okay. And I know you're also sharing some pretty cool stuff on Twitter too. I can link to all those various things in the show notes. Well, thank you a ton for being my guest on the show today, Guillaume. This has been fascinating, and I am itching to start using ScoopIt a lot more as a result of this. Hopefully other people are too.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Thanks for the opportunity, Joel.
All right. Man, I hope you are half as geeked up as I am about awesome curating conversations like the one I just had with Guillaume. If you enjoyed what he talked about, let him know on Twitter at GDECUGIS or check out his ScoopIt page at scoop.it/U/GDECUGIS. And while we're still on the topic of curating, here is that idea that I promised to tell you about at the top of the show. I've never mentioned this to anyone before, so I am stoked to hear whether you think this needs to happen like yesterday or is so lame that I should edit out this part of the episode and then we pretend like this never happened. Okay, here is the concept. Now, I'm thinking of an every other weekend article on Value of Simple with the best resources and content that I've absorbed and that other people have sent my way to review. I'd probably call it something like the Curator's Edge, and there would be standard categories for the things I'm most interested in and, of course, the things that you're most interested in, too. I'm talking about the finest content in personal finance, organizing, simplifying, health, personal relationships, and, you guessed it, curating itself. I'm imagining something a bit short on the word count, but very heavy on the context. And the resources and content that I would feature could be from the previous day, or it could be from 200 years ago. Because I don't know what you think, but I believe that the best stuff isn't always the newest stuff. And actually, it's frequently some older stuff that got an improper burial. I want to dig up those gems and show them to you. So what do you think about it? What topics would you like me to cover in a recurring series like The Curator's Edge? Would you want something more frequent than every other week? Would you want me to send the best resources and content that you know about in the categories that I cover so that I can highlight your amazing contributions too? Dust or blast me with your thoughts in any number of ways, including Twitter by sending a tweet to @JoelZeslowski, via email at joel@valueofsimple.com, or my newest experiment in feedback, voicemail. You will notice that at least as of right now, November 2013, every page on Value of Simple, except the homepage, has a new button on the right middle edge to click on to leave me a voicemail. SpeakPipe is the name of the service that powers this function, and I've played around with it a bit. Gotta tell you, I dig it. So why don't you try it out right now by going to the show notes for this episode, which you can find at valueofsimple.com/SASM035. Click on that old button labeled Send Voicemail and let me literally hear your thoughts. The future of the Curator's Edge and just about everything else I do on Smart and Simple Matters and Value of Simple is, as always, in your hands. All you got to do is briefly tell me what you want. It's really that simple. Okay, well, my voice is starting to get strained with all this talking, and I better sign off before I get tempted to do the "Oh Yeah" song again. You know you want to hear it. I'll hold off for now. If you've already left a review of the show on iTunes, though, you are freaking awesome. If not, today can be the day by going to valuesimple.com/iTunes, because each review earns my gratitude and helps the show a ton by allowing other people to find it easier. You and I aren't the only ones who should be benefiting from the cool wisdom that guests on the show share. Am I right? Okay, thank you for listening to another episode, and let me know what you've curated from this one. You rock, my friend, and I cannot wait to hit you with the next episode that is totally different from any others I've ever done. It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of all things Value of Simple.